It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. At least once a month, we dedicate an hour on this program to talking about the wildlife and wild places of Iowa. This hour, we are going farther afield, all the way to Brazil, and wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here. Hello, Jim.
Hi. How are you, Charity?
Great. Welcome home.
Well, thank you. Yes, we got home just a week ago, in fact, and we had about an 80-degree Fahrenheit temperature change from what we'd been experiencing in South America. So it was quite a shock. I had expected some change.
Well, you always like to miss the muddy season. So
yes.
There, you succeeded this time. No.
That's
mud.
Exactly right. Yeah. So I should say I was traveling on a trip called The Wilds of Brazil. That I put together with a company called Legacy Tours out of Fort Dodge. They were terrific in helping me put this together, and we contracted with for part of the time with Charles Munn, who runs a company called South Wild out of the Amazon and the Pantanal. So we visited in 2 weeks. Two of the major biodiversity places in the world, the Amazon Basin and the Pantanal, and they're connected sort of on the north edge. The Pantanal is sort of technically right next to the Amazon. So a truly incredible adventure with 28 Iowans, and it was a great trip.
When you talk about mega diversity,
yeah,
what does it feel like to be in one of these wild places? Because there's nowhere in Iowa that can compare as far as having wild creatures around you like this.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, actually, the only comparison I can think of for Iowans who have been here and seen lots of wild places in Iowa is during the migration. If you've ever been in western Iowa during the snow goose migration or the waterfowl migration, having 10 to 15 different species by the thousands around you, it's pretty amazing. That's the closest I can come, and that's certainly just dealing with waterfowl. But certainly, when you're in the midst of the Pantanal, for example, I should explain what the Pantanal is. The Pantanal is this basin in right on the border of sort of southwestern or west central Brazil, almost directly west of Brasilia, right on the border with Bolivia, and it's a very large. It's the largest freshwater wetland area in the world. And as a result, it is it's on the edge of the Cerrado, which means savanna, and it's a huge basin. So they're surrounded by mountains. The mountains feed water into this basin, and because it's savanna, it's very dry for much of the year, and then the water can rise from 1 to 3 meters in during the rainy season. So it's flooded regularly and then retreats back into the numerous rivers that are there. During the dry season, we were right on the edge, the beginning end of the rainy season. So they were beginning to fill. The rivers were rising. The wetlands were the numerous wetlands in the basins in the bottom of the savanna. There are filled with lots of birds, lots of wildlife, and we can actually see some of these here today because I've. You've graciously put them on the website.
That's right. You can go to iowapublicradio.org and see a slideshow of some of the amazing pictures that Jim took on this most recent trip. You can also find a link to that on our Facebook page and on our Twitter feed as well. And I have to ask you, so it's exciting to be among all of these wild creatures. I had an experience in the Everglades a few years ago where it was so amazing to be there, and it was just teeming with life.
Sure.
And then the sun went down, uh-huh. and as evening came on, and the mosquitoes started to swarm, I thought, I could die here.
Yes, you could.
So is it a little unnerving, too?
Well, yes and no. You certainly feel the power of the some of the critters that are there. The big caimans that are, you know, some of them a couple of meters, two and a half meters long.
That's the cover picture of your slideshow.
Right,
for
right.
People who aren't familiar with caimans.
Yeah, that's called the yacaré caiman, and it is found in the Pantanal. This particular one has his mouth open, and he's I guess you could say he's smiling, but he really is thermoregulating. You
so
notice
he's panting?
No, it's just exposing the red area of the inside of their mouth. That's how they thermoregulate. They'll get out on these beaches and bask in the sun. But sometimes the sun can be very, very intense, and so they need to kind of cool off a little bit. So they pump blood, more blood, into the surface tissues of their mouth and sit there with their mouth open, and the air goes over that and helps cool them off or
and
keep them.
And you can see every single one of those incredibly sharp teeth.
Yeah, and the teeth are really important, but they're primarily fish eaters, and that's the thing about the Pantanal and the Amazon, is that the fishery is really what supports the whole system. Because these rivers, both in the Pantanal and in the Amazon, the larger Amazon basin, are not there's not a single dam on them. There are very few bridges over them. These are rivers are allowed to do what rivers do, and that is particularly on an annual basis. They flood. They go up from in the Amazon. It can go up 30 feet in a single rainy season, and flooding everything, spreading out on its floodplain, just as rivers try to do here in Iowa. And in the process, when it goes back down, it enriches that fishery to the point. And I'm not just talking about the fish. I'm talking about all the mollusks, that the mussels, the invertebrates, that whole aquatic system there. It enriches it to the point that the fish are not only abundant in terms of species abundance, and they're in the Amazon, there, for example, there are like 3,000 known species of fish. It enriches their numbers as well. So there's terrific variety of aquatic life, and the caiman here, the black caiman, and other species take advantage of that.
With all of these species, we had a program on last week. We were talking about biodiversity and the incredible number of extinctions that are going on our planet right now.
Right.
And we were talking about how there are so many species that we don't even know about yet, that we haven't even identified. In this environment, are there a lot of species that you may encounter that might be unnamed?
Certainly that's true in the insect world. Insects in particular are being discovered, species, whole species, sometimes families are being discovered almost on a weekly basis, new species all the time of insects. Birds, mammals, reptiles, amphibians, it's less common, but certainly every once in a while you'll read, maybe once a year or once every couple of years, we'll read about a new primate species, and certainly that is possible in the Amazon because much of it is unexplored by the scientific world. It is not unexplored by the human species because humans have lived there for over 10,000 years. Estimates are with some of the, by dating some of the pictographs and that in some parts of the Amazon basin, those are over 10,000 years old. So if the pictographs have been there that long, certainly human beings have been. So there are a lot of areas that are unexplored by modern science, but not by human beings. But yeah, so there are certainly species we don't know about, but it's mostly in the insect world. Not unlikely to find some in mammals and probably reptiles, amphibians as well.
Now, as alarming as the caimans look, And you say they're mostly fish eaters. Do the other animals respond to their presence, or do they mostly just think, oh, they're just going to go eat some fish, so they're not going to bother me?
Well, we found lots of times as we would be going along the rivers in the Pantanal, there were often capybaras, and the next picture is actually a picture of a capybara. This is the largest rodent in the world. And
how big are they? They're giant, and they're so beautiful. But how big are they?
They really are quite amazing. These are pig-sized critters. We're talking...
Not guinea pig, but pig.
Well, they're related to guinea pigs.
Okay.
They're related to guinea pigs. But yeah, we're talking anywhere from 75 to up to 150 pounds. You know?
Wow.
So this is a big critter. And they're very unusual looking and very much made for the aquatic world. If you notice that next slide there, they have their noses and their eyes and their ears are all sort of on the top of their skulls. So they're like a beaver and
right.
a muskrat here. They're placed high, so they're really well made for being in the water, so that they're just their nostrils and their tiny ears and their eyes can be out of the water.
In fact, there's a picture later in the slideshow of a bird perching on the head of one of them.
Yes.
So they almost look a little like hippos.
Yeah, they do.
But they're smaller than hippos.
Smaller than hippos, right? This picture actually has one young capybara nursing on its mom and a male there. And you can tell that's a male. If you look on the top of the nose, they have those, they're actually a scent gland that is on the top of the nose. And it's the females have them, but they're certainly more prominent on the males. They live in family groups. Often it was not unusual to see six to a dozen, but you could see groups occasionally during the dry season of up to 100 individuals.
Wow. All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. I'm talking with wildlife biologist Jim Pease, who has just returned from Brazil, and we're talking about the wildlife of Brazil today. We are talking about some pictures that Jim took on his journey. You can see a slideshow of those photos on our website, iowapublicradio.org. We'll continue in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is wildlife biologist Jim Pease. He has just returned from one of his annual journeys to Brazil, part of a tour that he leads to the wilds of Brazil with Legacy Tours. And we're talking about some of the amazing creatures that he encountered on this journey and the biodiversity of this region that he visited. And we were talking about capybaras before the break, and I don't think we should leave that subject quite yet. So they're just enormous rodents.
Yes, yeah. They think, yeah, my wife, the first time that Cindy and I went there, she said, oh, they're so cute. And I said, think rodent, honey. And they really are cute. I have to admit, they're very, very cute, very unusual looking.
Yeah. Well, and you know, when you think about a rodent, you do expect them to be closer to the ground.
Right.
And obviously, they're made for the water and for swimming, but they also are up off the ground. It looks like they can make some time on land, too.
They certainly can. And in fact, when they're being pursued by a jaguar, which we'll talk about in a bit, they can move pretty quickly on land. Scamper, I would say, is a great way to put it. But they almost always retreat to the water because the water is probably their safest place. If you're very young, if you're a baby caiman or a baby capybara, certainly a large caiman might be a threat. But if you're an adult, caimans are no threat at all. Your major two species that are predators for you are the jaguar and anaconda snakes, big anaconda snakes. So, and we only saw one anaconda while we were there, and it was a fairly small one, only about 6 feet long. So it was it wasn't that big. So,
being rodents, are they entirely herbivorous? Do they just eat plants?
Yes, they are. Okay. Yeah. In fact, the a little later in the slideshow, you'll see a capybara, and they're actually submerged because this is a wetland area. Lots and lots of wetlands. These are wetlands in the middle of a savanna, so and the rivers that are along them often have dense forest right along them. Savannas, just like here, mean, and like in Africa, mean more scattered trees. So that's true out in the floodplains of the Pantanal. But close to the rivers, the forests are quite dense. They're what we call gallery forests. So they're right along the rivers, and they might only be from a few meters to 100 or so meters wide, sometimes wider, but the denser forests are right along the rivers. And so that's where the capybaras are, is right along the rivers. And so are their predators as a result. And that's why you get to see them so much. But capybaras will submerge themselves in the wetlands that during the dry season the wetlands are there, and they eat grasses. And that's what the one in that photo was doing, is actually eating what's called capybara grass, and it's a relative of our barnyard grass here in Iowa, and same genus, different species, and so they're consuming grasses primarily. Now, grasses are, as cattle know and horses know, are tough to break down the lignans to make them nutritious. So you either have to be a ruminant and therefore sort of regurgitate and re-chew it, or you have to be caprophagous like rabbits are. And rabbits eat some of their own feces to re-digest. It's a process of re-digestion. Great dinner time conversation here. And capybaras do the same thing. So capybaras are caprophagous and partially ruminant in that they'll regurgitate some to re-chew it, sort of like chewing the cud.
Okay. And like do they have dens or nests or lodges?
No, they don't. You will see them sometimes sort of in small groups, four or five of them, on floating vegetation as it's going down a river.
Oh, wow.
So they're like looking at you like, yeah, I'm on a raft, so what? You know, so it's just great. They'll move around. Their normal home range seems to be about 25 to 40 acres. So they're often in the same area. Now, the capybaras here in the Pantanal, I mentioned earlier, you can see groups of up to 100, but that's very unusual in the Pantanal, probably because of the high predation rate. While a female can have, four, five, six young, you usually only see them with one or two, and there are some pretty high predation rates, I think, of capybaras.
So they'll have a litter that large, and
right.
Then mm-hmm. only a couple will survive.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Exactly. And even adult capybaras, there's a lot of meat on one. So boy, if a jaguar can bring down a capybara pretty easily, in fact, if they can catch them unawares, and that provides a tremendous amount of meat very quickly for them.
All right. Well, I think we better talk about jaguars. And you have some wonderful, wonderful pictures.
Yeah, and we actually saw, during the time we were there, all of us saw three individual jaguars. You can identify them individually by the patterns of spots on their faces. We saw a female and two males. And then one of the boats, a small group, saw two more, a mother and a cub, scent marking on a tree, where they, just like bears and other cats do, they'll get up on a tree and scratch it, with their front claws, and then they got in the water and were swimming across. The jaguar is the largest. It's one of the three largest cats in the world, the tiger and the lion being the other one. This is certainly the largest predator in the Americas, in the Western Hemisphere, and is an amazing critter, both in terms of sheer size. We're talking females that can be upwards of 150 pounds to 200 pounds is pretty
wow.
Not unusual, to big males that can be up to 300 pounds or more. And so these are big cats, 6 feet long, the big males from the tip of their nose to the tip of their tail, You know, a couple meters like that is not unusual at all.
Wow, and so beautiful.
Oh, they're just gorgeous. Yeah.
Well, we have a little sound of a jaguar growl.
All
here.
Right.
Now, of course.
They're one of the few that can actually roar. So
yeah.
That was a warning growl, I think.
We were just starting
right,
there.
Right.
And
yeah.
And do they have sort of family collective units like some of the other big cats?
No, they're very solitary. The female and her one or two young, usually one, but occasionally two. They can have more than that, but it's not very common. The female will have her young with her for a year or more, and but otherwise lives pretty solitarily, and the males do as well. There are certainly overlapping home ranges, particularly the females. The males tend to establish a little more territory, but as we discovered, there's often overlapping of those home ranges and what they call core areas. There's especially true in females, but occasionally in males as well. It's interesting that in the Pantanal, Brazil actually banned hunting in the 1970s, I believe, and since then, and in particular. The jaguar was in real danger until then, still is not out of the woods. But the jaguar population in the Pantanal is probably it's the densest known population of jaguars in the Americas, and is doing very, very well there. They're keeping good track of them.
And you have a photo of a big, lazy-looking jaguar yawning.
Yep.
And also laying on the ground. Do you tend to encounter them on the ground, or do they spend a lot of time up in trees?
They don't need to spend a lot of time in trees. In fact, most of their prey is on the ground. The capybaras and the caimans are two of their major prey species. And because caimans and capybaras are found on the ground, jaguars are mostly found on the ground. They can climb trees. They tend not to bother much in the Pantanal because most of their prey is on the ground. It's not to say they won't occasionally climb. All the ones that we saw were certainly on the ground, and really no reason for them. And you can see by the yawn, we actually watched three of these cats for over an hour each. It was
wow.
remarkable to be able to sit there.
So they're not afraid of humans?
Well, what's interesting, in this particular area is a very large sport fishing industry in the rivers. So they're very accustomed to boats going up and down the river, and they actually pay them no mind at all. So we would see them and simply stop the boat, and if you can throw out an anchor and sit and watch them for a long, long time. And if they're just sleeping, sometimes one of them was actually hunting a little bit, you can watch them. As long as you're quiet, don't make rapid movements or scream or yell at them, and that, just sit there. It is quite easy to see them. So,
wow, I'm sure these are very, very, very large cats. So I'm sure that some humans are afraid of them. Do they have any negative encounters with humans?
Yeah, it would certainly be. I've got a dog in the background.
No, it's construction, I believe, in our AIM site.
Oh,
is that the case? It sounds like a dog barking, but I don't think we have a dog in the studios today.
So, we just had some interference here. So anyway, the question again was
are people afraid of jaguars? Is there any reason to be?
Well, they certainly, being large predators, they're opportunistic, and they will take other species that are easy for them to take, including cattle. And because the Pantanal certainly has cattle, it's a very large cattle-growing region, it being a savanna, a grassland-based area, there are a lot of cattle in the area. So some ranchers, jaguars certainly take some cattle occasionally, and some ranchers quite honestly have them, hire, although it's totally illegal, both nationally and internationally, they do kill some jaguars. So there's some reason for that. Now, if I were hiking in the woods, I would certainly, where there were lots of jaguars around, it's certainly not recommended to spend a lot of time alone walking. You are potential prey as well. This is a very large predator and certainly could take down a human, but there aren't known cases where that's happened very often at all. So all right. It's not a big concern.
Well, when interacting with my cats, I'm often grateful that they're not 300 pounds. So
you find that they lay in wait for you.
Depends on the day.
Yeah,
there's
an incredible video. People can find it. Our listeners can find it on I think it's on YouTube. With if you just Google jaguar eating caiman, it's an amazing picture taken, and we actually saw the place where it was taken on the river we were on, where the jaguar actually swims across behind a beach area where a caiman, a very large caiman, is basking, and the jaguar sneaks up, grabs this full-grown, about 2-meter-long caiman by the neck, and this is the thing about jaguars. They have this incredibly powerful jaw muscles, and they're able to pierce not only the backbone but the skull of the animal right through the protective armor of a caiman.
Wow.
And pierce the skull, and he carries away, just like he's carrying away a dog bone, this very large caiman.
Jaguar hunting, what were they hunting?
Anything that were moving along the way, and they would certainly, I'd say he was hunting because he was creeping and looking around while he was going along the shore. But
You didn't see success. You saw
no.
The
although
effort.
It was fascinating, as we sat there watching one of them. There was a small group of capybaras kind of floated by on the water, and he certainly became interested, but he didn't get up and go after them. So it was, and there are sometimes interactions between jaguars and what are called giant otters. This is another species that is in the Pantanal. These are otters that are very gregarious, family groups of otters. And these are twice the size of our river otters. So these are 2 meters long.
But they're like river otters. They live in freshwater.
Yes, they live in freshwater, but they're huge, and they have very flat tails as opposed to the round tails of river otters. And while we were watching this one, a river otter or a giant otter did kind of swim up and kind of look. It got up on a log and looked at the jaguar, sort of going, talking to him a little bit, like nah, 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 nah. It's quite fun to watch. So a great interaction between species. So
you also shared a picture of some birds giving an alarm call.
Right.
Those birds with their young.
Yeah, these are called screamers. Southern screamers. They're both horn screamers in the Amazon basin, and then you get down into the Pantanal, and there's a different species of screamer. These are, it's called the southern screamer. These are turkey-sized birds, they do, in fact, scream. It's not a beautiful call. It's just sort of a scream.
I'll bet you can give us an approximation.
No, I really can't do it justice at all. So
it was worth a try.
It's sort of a something
nice.
Like that. It wasn't very good. But, any of our listeners out there have actually heard them and going, it doesn't sound like that. but there are, it's a very loud scream. And these birds are, you see this huge bird in a treetop and you think, my gosh, that bird looks better on the ground, you know, a little more in place on the ground. So they're an amazing, just this incredible variety. We saw nearly 300 species. I haven't added them all up yet, but we're in the 300 species range of just of birds.
Wow.
Yeah. It was pretty amazing.
That's
pretty
awesome. Amazing, so. Well, we are going to take another short break. We'll be back in just a moment to talk more about the wildlife of Brazil with wildlife biologist Jim Pease, who's just returned from one of his annual trips to Brazil. And you're welcome to join our conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We'll continue the conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the wildlife of Brazil with wildlife biologist Jim Pease. He's just returned from an annual journey to Brazil with Legacy Tours. It's called The Wilds of Brazil. And you are welcome to join our conversation, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Jim has also shared some of the amazing pictures that he took on this latest trip with us. You can find that slideshow on our website, iowapublicradio.org. We also have a link up on our Facebook page as well. And let's talk birds for just a few minutes, and we've got some people who want to get in on the conversation.
Great.
As well. But so many birds.
Yeah, we're talking... Brazil has an amazing diversity of birds, in part because of the mostly because of the Amazon and the Pantanal. There are something like 1,600 species of birds in Brazil, many of them endemic, only found there, particularly in the Amazon or in the Pantanal. They also have an area called the Atlantic Rainforest, which is along the eastern coast, which has been terribly fragmented because that's where most of the people live, of course. But there are a number of important species there. But so if we look at the slideshow, we've got represented here the black skimmer, which is a gull-sized bird. It has this weird bill. The lower mandible is longer than the upper mandible, the upper bill. And
Little bit of an underbite.
Yeah. And if you've been to the coasts, you may have seen, particularly along the East Coast, you may have seen some of these birds are in Florida occasionally. You see them as they fly very low over the water with that lower mandible, their bill open, so they actually skim insects and very small fish right off the top of the water. So they're a cool species. There's a grassland species there, the black-capped Donacobius. The Donacobius is I would say it's a robin-sized bird, maybe a cardinal-sized bird is more accurate, related to the flycatchers. Beautiful colors here with this gorgeous black head and cream-colored neck and belly, their chest and belly. They're really beautiful. There are pictures of cocoi herons, also called the white-necked heron, sort of related, same size virtually as our great blue heron, or the great egrets, and we find great egrets there, and I did see one great blue heron there as well. Cocoi herons are found, it seems like, about every 100 meters along many of the rivers that we run. They're just incredibly beautiful,
How
graceful
tall
birds.
Would you say they are?
Well, you've got the same size as a great blue heron. You're talking, it stands four plus feet high. So as it's standing, very long legs and long neck.
The vegetation's so lush in your pictures, it's hard to get it.
Hard to tell.
Right?
yeah. It's amazing. So there's a whole group of birds that are totally tropical, and there's one called the blue-crowned trogon. Trogons are... We once did a program on Costa Rica on this program from trips I lead to Costa Rica as well, and trogons include the amazing quetzal, a resplendent quetzal, in the group, and these are primarily fruit eaters. So there's a picture of a blue-crowned trogon in here, beautiful blue-green sort of head, big yellow eye ring, this gorgeous scarlet chest and belly, and green back, and a very heavily black and white striped tail. These are fruit eaters, and they're all, this whole family is tropical, and many bird species, and particularly the trogons, are important for seed dispersal from trees and vines, and they're important because in the tropics, instead of a single species of tree dominating an area, you might have such low densities of a tree that in order to get its seeds spread, it depends on other species to take those seeds elsewhere. And trogons eat the fruit and then either spit out the seed, if they're very large seeds, or poop out the seed elsewhere in the woodland. And so they're very important seed dispersers. There's also a picture of some very large birds over 5 feet tall on the nest. These are two what are called Jabiru storks. The beak alone is about a foot and a half long.
Wow.
These birds. They're massive beaks, and they eat fish, but they also eat primarily eels that are buried down in the mud of some of these wetlands.
And they have a giant nest at the top of a tree.
And they're standing on it. Right. That's how big it is. So you're talking a 5 foot tall bird, and they have a young in the nest, and they're regurgitating food for this young until they can the young can be old enough to fledge and join them down the way. So,
well, I don't want to short the primates at all either. So let's take a couple calls, and then
sure.
I think we could probably talk about birds for several hours.
Yes, we could.
All right, Ginny's on the line next in Ames. Hi, Ginny.
Hi. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
Ginny.
Hi.
First of all, thank you for sharing all of your knowledge and enthusiasm for Brazil on the trip. I went on the trip, and it was fabulous.
Great.
but my thinking of it since we got back, I just wondered what are the really crucial parts of the Pantanal habitat that are needed to support the animals at the top of the food chain, like the jaguar?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think number one is the fact that the river's allowed to do what the river has always done, and that is flood on an annual basis and that in turn supports this incredible fishery, this incredible aquatic life system that supports everything above it in that system. So that's number one. I would say secondly is the important relative lack of development. One of the things I wrote about with the group that when I was down there was I said, you know, for now wildness is winning. But there are lots of threats to it. The biggest threat in the savanna in general is basically North American style farming. We're talking soybean production, and there have been many, many thousands of acres of savanna and rainforest, Amazon rainforest, converted to soybean production. Seems incredible to me how we could not only allow that but encourage that to happen in this incredibly biodiverse area. The Amazon and the Pantanal, being mega diversity areas, are have those kinds of threats on the edges constantly. And I think if we are to allow humans and other species to coexist, we need to save these as large an area of these mega diversity areas as we possibly can.
When you talk about agriculture and encroaching on these diverse areas, when we think about Iowa pre-settlement,
yeah.
Would it have felt? I mean, it's not a rainforest. It's not warm. But
right. Yeah.
But would the diversity of wild creatures have felt something similar to this?
Yeah, I think if you read Lewis and Clark journals about this being a country so full of game, was a direct quote from their journals, where they were talking herds of bisons and you know, something we will never know for sure, but estimates range from 40 to 60 million bison on the Great Plains, including Iowa. Elk were here, you know, by the many hundreds of thousands. You know, I think it may have felt something very similar to that in those days, but we'll certainly never know. But Lewis and Clark journals certainly indicate that this was a pretty diverse place at one time, yeah.
Jenny, thank you so much for your call, and Sam is on the line next in Iowa City. Hi, Sam.
Oh, hello. Say, I've been to Brazil maybe 10 times, working primarily on diversity discovery, and in my case, earthworms.
Oh, great. That's a great, great subject.
And, you know, you mentioned earlier, okay, yeah, mostly it's in the insects. Well, there's a lot of earthworms out there as well.
Stand corrected and absolutely right. Yeah, yeah. So.
And lots of other things. But what I think is remarkable about Brazil and earthworms is that it seems to be the home of the world's most amazing collection of gigantic earthworms.
Wow, that's great.
Things like, you know, garden hose diameter and maybe 6 feet long.
Wow,
that's amazing. We need some pictures of those, too.
Yeah, definitely. And so do you have to dig a hole to see them?
Well, when we got up in the north side of the Amazon basin in Amapá, now, we knew they were there. The people in the area said, yeah, we see these things all the time after it rains.
And, wow.
You know, birds of prey come down and eat them. And we ended up, because it's a gold mining area, we had a guy with a Fiat Alice cubic meter bucket backhoe drive his beast out of the pit that he was mining gold in and just dug down into the forest floor and pulled out, like, five of them at once.
That's amazing.
Like,
yeah.
Well, the spaghetti hanging down from.
Wow.
Yeah, it's amazing. Well, and certainly the soil diversity, as well as insect diversity, the critters in the soil, the all of the various annelids and et cetera. You're absolutely right. It's amazing diverse, and that's amazingly diverse. And probably we know less about that than just about anything, out of sight, out of mind kind of thing. We did see several a number of butterflies, of course. I didn't put any of those photos up, but there are a number of butterfly species we saw. In addition, we did see a place where they had excavated out a cicada, essentially tunnel down into the soil that went down about a meter and a half, 2 meters into the soil and was totally encased. Really amazing thing. And we saw, of course, lots of species of ants, including leafcutter ants and army ants. And I did put one photo in there of what I call bridging, where ants, army ants, in order to climb basically a curb, a wall there. They bridged up, a swarm of them bridged up over the edge. And it's amazing. Ant diversity is one of the, of course, the famous Harvard ecologist E.O. Wilson made his scientific career studying ants. And
right.
I think his estimates are that on a single species, tropical species of tree, there might be 100 species of ants on a single large tropical forest tree.
Wow.
So yeah, so they're truly remarkable, and we got to see several species of ants while we were there.
Well, Sam, thank you so much for your call, and seriously, I would like to see some pictures of
these
earthworms. So
that'd be wonderful.
Email them along to Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org. And Jim, we have just a few minutes left, so let's talk about primates. You mentioned that occasionally there's still a new species of primate discovered,
right?
Which kind of boggles my mind.
It does, yeah.
What are the primate species that you encounter the most?
Well, we encountered a number of primate species, including, and I have one here of the squirrel monkey. These are you know, a foot long body size, and then another couple of feet for tail. Very fast little guys, almost fearless, and come around you. We also saw I saw pied marmosets, which are very, very uncommon. We got to see the very rare golden-faced Saki monkeys. We saw capuchins. We didn't see the big woolly monkeys that we'd hoped to see, but next time perhaps we'll get to see those. But a number of species, and I think I've got two. I've got both the squirrel monkey on here, and I think I have the capuchin as well, the brown capuchin.
So. Right. Now, how are these species faring?
Well, they seem to be doing okay. Certainly the squirrel monkeys, being very, very adaptable, are doing all right. Monkeys are, you know, primates, it's very difficult to, they're often difficult to study. You've had Jill on your program talking about
chimpanzees, yes.
in Africa, but monkeys, as she knows, can be often difficult to study, and perhaps are often misunderstood. They still are used in much of the world for bushmeat, and the relationship to Ebola and other things there is quite interesting. But like all species, the more generalist they are in their diets and in their abilities to adapt, the better they fare in the presence of humans. The more specialized the primate is, the more problems they'll have, particularly as humans come into an area. So the marmosets tend to be very secretive, very, very much more specialized in their diets and their ability to withstand human beings than the squirrel monkeys and the capuchins, for example, or even the howlers. We also saw howlers, and they seem to be doing just fine.
Learning about these creatures is fun. It's fascinating. Why do you think it's important for those of us here at home in Iowa to know about these creatures?
Yeah, I think it's perhaps getting back to what we talked about a little bit earlier. Iowa used to be a very, very diverse place. And while we still celebrate the wildlife that we have here in Iowa, I think we need to remember how diverse it once was. And I think visiting places that are these mega diversity places is important for a number of reasons. Number one, we give Brazil a reason to save them. Tourism is a very, very important industry. It gives local people a reason to make sure that that the rainforest and the critters that are there continue to exist. It gives them some income, quite honestly, and that's important. It's one way that we can contribute to their economies to make sure these places stay wild. It's also the Amazon rainforest is the lungs of the earth, and these wild areas perhaps will not be wild forever. We can help keep them that way.
Jim Pease, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Wildlife biologist Jim Pease just returned from a trip to Brazil. You can see the slideshow of some of the amazing pictures he took on that journey at iowapublicradio.org. Just look for Talk of Iowa. You can also find the link on our Facebook page. And Jim will be back again next month. We'll probably talk about Iowa creatures next month. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, the unpublished autobiography of Laura Ingalls Wilder. This is Talk of Iowa.